members who are not boycotting.
Hey.
For the moment.
For the moment. Open the Senate Revenue Committee. The schedule for today is, if all goes as planned, is to do a work session on 2131 first. Members, this is the MDAC bill that we heard last week passed the floor. There's a conflict amendment that we need to adopt. And then my hope would be to send it back out this afternoon.
Mr. Chairman, are we in a work session?
We are about to be. Then we'll do House Bill 2187, and then we'll do House Bill 2589. Open a work session on House Bill 2131.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we reconsider the vote whereby House Bill 2131 was sent out of committee, and we bring it back for consideration.
Senator Hannon has moved that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2131.
Right.
Discussion. Those of the opinion, the rules should be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2131. Vote aye. Those opposed, no. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator
Sharpen?
Aye.
Hannon?
Aye.
Ringo?
Aye.
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 Motion passes.
Mr. Chairman, there is a conflict amendment on House Bill 2131, identified as -A3, dated 4/29/03, and I would move that we insert that amendment into House Bill 2131.
Senator Hannon has moved that we reconsider the vote by which 2131 was sent to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Those opinion that we should reconsider the vote by which we first suspended the vote.
Right, okay.
House Bill 2131 was sent to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Will vote aye. Those opposed, no. Kara.
Senator
Coleman?
Aye.
Hannon?
Aye.
Ringo?
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Aye. Motion carries.
Mr. Chairman, now I would move that we take the amendment identified as House Bill 2131-A3, dated 4/29/03, and insert that in the House Bill 2131.
Thank you. Senator Hannon has moved that we adopt the A3 amendments to House Bill 2131. Discussion. With the purpose of resolving conflicts with the bill.
Correct.
Thank you.
That's what I said.
Discussion. Objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chairman, I would now move House Bill 2131 as amended out to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Senator Hannon has moved House Bill 2131 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Any discussion?
You're pretty confident for an old guy. I'm really impressed.
See, you tell me everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, this was the highly technical MDAC bill that we all wanted that Senator Courtney, given his technical expertise in terms of lending practices, to carry. That's still the will of the committee. We will
absolutely
move that upon passage.
Absolutely. Senator Courtney, it is.
Any objections to moving this bill along back to the floor? So the Senate President will be our carrier.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Hannon.
Could the record show that there were 6 members in attendance without boycotting?
Yes. We have 6, now 5.
Now 5.
You've got to have 4. I've got to go see the state police for just a minute. I'll be right back.
I hope that all goes well with the state police.
Thank you so much.
Open a public hearing on House Bill 2187. Mr. Malik, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2187 comes from the House Revenue Committee, passed the floor. Originally came from the Department of Revenue. And in a nutshell, House Bill 2187 attempts to resolve a certain conflict with the issues of the urban renewal revenues. The urban renewal revenue are either raised by special levy or by division of tax. And as a result of a court case, the Shiloh Inn versus Multnomah County. The judgment of the court was that the urban renewal revenues out of any source that needs to be for the purpose of Measure 5 categorized as in the government section and not to be taken as part of the education $5 limit that is imposed by Measure 5. And in doing so, of course, the that has certain issues were brought out, is that what the division of tax has been between the time of Measure 5 until Measure 50, and then how it was treated at that time, what kind of compression was caused for the education and the government categories of Measure 5. This House bill would basically allow the Department of Revenue to go into the rules and into the statutes on following the court case. A result of that would probably be less compression loss for schools, and perhaps if the certain government category on some districts is towards the top of the $10 limit of Measure 5, that will put the government category under more compression. Property owners would probably see mixed results. Some would see increase, some would see decrease, depending on which district and which property and the compression levels that they live in. In your packet, I've included two examples of an area code of what would have been the case before the Shiloh Inn judgment and after the court case. And in essence, what have occurred with the court case is that the division of taxes that is the main source for revenue for the urban renewal has moved from being considered at the time after the taxes are raised to more like division of the rate itself. And in this example that we have of a real market value of the area code and the assessed value being at $1 million, if you see that all the rates did not change per se, the amount of tax imposed and the amount of tax collected does change from 1725 to 1625. The compression also changes, moving more compression towards the government category and less compression from the schools. I could go more into the examples if you would like, but at this time I'll leave it up to you. The revenue impact out of this, Mr. Chair, would be no impact since we have the compliance or the need for compliance with the court case would occur at any rate, and therefore this bill in its most pure form would bring the statutes into compliance with the court decision. So no new losses or increases of revenue because of that.
Mr. Kemp?
Yeah, Senator Gringo.
Well, I certainly don't follow all of that. I'd like to ask this question. Did the court decision you're referring to, the Shiloh Inns decision, did that cause of loss of revenue to the government, to schools or different government entities?
Senator Gringo, it has allowed the compression rate, if you will. Of course, the main two main categories are the $5 for schools and then the $10 for government. The way it was done, suppose that your rate is $5 on the schools. You would raise the $5 out of the $1,000, split the amount of revenue, and then that amount of revenue would half go, if it was at 50%, division of tax, let's say. Because urban renewal freezes the time by which you start assessing the revenue. If it was at a certain percentage, 50%, 50% of the revenue would go to the schools and 50% would go to the urban renewal district. After the case, the 50% still go. But if the rate was above the 5%, the amounts that go from the school category to the urban renewal does not count against the $5 limit anymore. It starts counting against the $10 limit of the government,
mm-hmm.
which in a way opened, if you will, a slice of cap for the schools to collect more on the permanent rate without being compressed any further.
I see.
So it didn't actually increase the rate or decrease it per se, but it allowed them more opening, which if they have more, they could probably go and get a local option to fill that gap if the gap exists at this time. Why? It pushed it to the government section. So if the government section is almost at the ceiling, it got compressed a lot.
I see.
More.
You're at 15.
$10 at the government level.
Mr. Fair, so I just need to rephrase this. That Shiloh Inns decision then helped schools and hurt local governments. In just as a general statement.
In a general statement, that is correct. Yes.
And we're codifying that decision, so we're codifying that impact.
That's correct. That's what that bill does.
Okay. Thank you.
And in the examples I put, there's some code areas would actually experience a reduction in taxes. This is one of them. It's going from 16,000 to 17,000, or from 17,500 to 16,250. So there is a net reduction in taxes because of all the compression that was pushed on the government side.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
I was just wondering whether there's any input from either the school folks or the city folks on this. I guess not.
We're going to have some testimony.
Oh, we are? Okay.
From
okay,
the folks that have been pushing this.
Okay.
What would be the consequences, Mazin, of not codifying the Shiloh decision?
Mr. Chair, the Supreme Court have judged that this is the intent of the Constitution. This is the way the Constitution should have been treated. It almost would push it to court again.
Put it back into the courts.
In a sense, you would leave this constitutional gap between the constitutional language and the laws, the ORS.
So they'd have to reinterpret the fact that we decided not to.
I'm not. This is probably getting a little more legal than I would be able to answer, but I would suspect the courts have already determined how the way it should be, and if the legislative body, or the legislative assembly, thinks there is a different interpretation as have seen, then this might need to be resolved further.
Senator,
I just want to ask Mazin a question here. If we codify this and somebody brought litigation at a time later would then we be throwing it back open for discussion? Following up on the chair's question about what would happen if we didn't codify it, what will happen if we do codify it? Will it still be subject to challenge?
Again, this is probably a little more on the legal side. I think since the courts have already interpreted it to be that way, I think the Department of Revenue and the executive branch in the different levels of government are complying with the court decision as it stood after Shiloh Inn.
Well, when Shiloh, it says here that Shiloh Inn versus Multnomah County et al., did they sue the Department of Revenue, or did they, on the interpretation of this, or did they interpret that it was Multnomah County's interpretation of it?
Chip, do you want to, or John, Chip and John, or just John?
Senator Hanna, I think...
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I'll just hold my comment so we have...
Well, let's get the... I think we're going to get the answer. Do you want
to... I just was going to say it's Multnomah County who was the other side of that.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Very good questions. My name is John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. This bill is one we brought to the legislature, and it's really because of this case decision, this opinion that was issued in the interim. The statute that was struck to be unconstitutional was a section that talked about the characterization of urban renewal revenues. That is an important piece for turning the tax rolls in every county last November. And so what we did after that opinion is the Department of Revenue promulgated a rule which said how taxes should be calculated given the decision. We had to make some calls on that. We were reporting at that time to the House Interim Revenue Committee and Representative Shetterly's committee. We reported in February, and we reported after the rule was promulgated in May. We took steps to involve as broad of a constituency or interest groups as possible, including the attorneys and counsel for the Shiloh litigant, the Portland Development Commission, cities, counties, everybody, interested citizens. And we did do that, and we did promulgate the rule. If you do nothing, counties will continue to calculate taxes according to the rule, which they did this past fall. So that is what will happen if you do nothing. We feel that there are some threads of policy that were made in the decision in the rules process, and we just felt like since we had to take those steps, we felt that it should be brought before you. I know there's a strong concern that agencies not just write rules that deal with policy issues without checking with you, and so this is why we brought this before you. It's consistent with what we discussed with the House Revenue Committee during the interim and during this session already, and I'd be happy to go into the detail about it and answer any questions.
Mr. Then what this language does in this bill, it incorporates what is being done administratively in the statute, so everybody knows from henceforth we're operating under this statute definition.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Chip Lazenby. I'm General Counsel for the Portland Development Commission. Senator Hannon also asked whether the Department of Revenue was an original party. They chose to intervene in the lawsuit because the nature of our lawsuit was involved locally in the Portland metropolitan area, but the implications were really statewide, and ultimately the department would have to promulgate rules and deal with it, and so they wanted to bring a statewide perspective to it. We've also recently, for the committee's information, resolved this lawsuit through a settlement, and that final judgment was entered in the tax court, I believe, last week. I was out of town, but I got reports when I got back that the case has been resolved. So we've completely resolved this case at this point, Don.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Then are other areas of the state who have urban renewal areas directly or indirectly affected by this court definition or this court decision?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, yes. Any area in the state that has urban renewal, Jackson County or Union?
Jackson County, Medford has urban renewal. What is the impact there? to local government versus schools.
Okay. Getting to impact, Senator Hannon. The impact, because of the tax system is designed the way it is, the impact will vary from account to account and from code area to code area, from urban renewal plan to urban renewal plan. So there will be some increases, there will be some decreases.
But it'll have a leveling effect out.
It can have a leveling effect. I don't think there's been any research in terms of how level that was.
Okay.
But in general, it would shift money to schools from local government.
Yeah.
Yes, Mr. Chair. In general, it increases the capacity in the education category. Mm-hmm. That may or may not cause impact in the general government category, but it does definitely shift the revenue to the general government category.
Okay. Thank you.
Anything further? Chip, does this bring finality to the case that the Shiloh Inn case, when this bill passes, if it does, and signed into law, is that...
My overall sense is that what 2187 does, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is that it brings finality to the administrative response from the Department of Revenue to the Shiloh case. What they did in administrative law, it now puts it into the statute. And there could be grounds. Someone raised the issue. Could someone challenge this in the future? I think they can challenge the statute because the Shiloh Inn's case was a constitutional question as whether this certain statutes violated measures 47 and 50 combination. They could similarly challenge this, although I think the people that worked very hard out of Department of Justice and Revenue on this, and certainly the urban renewal agencies are convinced that it complies with the Shiloh ruling and that's consistent with the constitutional law.
Mr. Chair, in the handout that I've provided, I just detail three points that the bill makes. The first point is the third bullet. It repeals the statute that was declared unconstitutional. Pretty straightforward change. The other two are sort of extensions of the logic of the Shiloh case, which weren't directly litigated, but which the point in the Shiloh we believe the court was making was that on the first page down toward the bottom, there's current law and there's a Shiloh decision. Under current law, or in the law at the time the Shiloh case was litigated, the category of the Measure 5, whether it's education or general government, was determined by the taxing district that levied the tax. That rate was applied, and it was that category to the extent that that levy or tax rate generated urban renewal revenues. That those revenues for urban renewal were categorized under education. The court found that to be unconstitutional. So what the court said is it's not the category of the taxing district that's actually levying the tax, it's the end use of the money. So if the end use of the money is urban renewal, which is a non-education function, then that is the category to which the urban renewal monies and revenues should be categorized. So I do provide an example. I won't go into it unless the committee is just desperately interested. I also provide several pages of analysis of what we tried to do in the rule, what the issues that were brought up during the hearing, the issues that we heard, and how we responded to those issues. And then finally, the last page is just essentially what the bill does and how it
does
it.
Question, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Farrelly.
The question is related to whether or not this actually produces a shift in revenue or just creates an opportunity by reducing compression. I mean, if you're categorizing these as general revenue funds, as opposed to specific accounts, like urban renewal, does not that have the effect of releasing some compression?
Mr. Chair, Senator Farrelly, the answer is really yes and no, I believe. Yes, it does release some compression on some accounts in the education category, and no, it wouldn't necessarily relieve compression on other accounts in the general government category.
But I guess what I'm also looking for is that there seems to be the assumption that this would automatically produce revenue for schools. And I'm under the impression it would not automatically produce revenue for schools.
Mr. Chair, Senator Federal, I wouldn't say that. I don't know that.
That answers my question, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Does the committee want Mr. Phillips to walk us through one example? Thank you, Mr. Phillips. Thank you, Mr. Lazenby. Mr. Tassin.
I could have had Mr. Lazenby walk us through that. I would have really enjoyed that.
We just want Mr. Lazenby to walk. Ouch.
He had a big weekend in Seattle with a big boys' weekend, lots of cigars and.
Uh-oh. Too much detail.
Oh yeah. And you mean you went?
Are you gonna listen? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Tashman, and I'm a consultant representing the Association of Oregon Redevelopment Agencies. It's called AORA. It's an affiliate of the League of Oregon Cities, and it represents urban renewal agencies statewide. AORA supports the bill. We feel that there was a very fair and open process that was conducted by the Department of Revenue to determine how to respond to the Shiloh decision, and we feel that the process resulted in a fair and equitable conclusion. And we especially want to commend the Department of Revenue for the process they used. They were very inclusive and worked in, you know, they just really invited all the parties to the table and worked through these issues, and they were certainly not simple issues. With the committee's indulgence, I'd like to talk for just for a couple of minutes about urban renewal in general. It's not an issue that we've had much opportunity to just make general presentations to the legislature on. But just a few notes. At this point, urban renewal remains the best and maybe the last tool that's under local control for promoting economic development or neighborhood revitalization. In the state, there are 68 urban renewal districts that have been adopted in 47 communities throughout every part of the state, with the exception of extremely eastern Oregon. We think that in the long term, urban renewal undeniably provides benefits in terms of additional property taxes, because urban renewal stimulates development and property values where it wouldn't otherwise occur to that extent. And so in the long term, there are greater revenues to schools and local governments because of urban renewal. In the short term, we believe that there are also some positive effects because urban renewal has been used successfully to create jobs and create income and thereby generate income tax. And in some of these cases, these are jobs that would not have located in the state of Oregon. So this is new revenue to the state. Perhaps the best example of that, and on the second page of my memo, I give some examples of some of the plans around the state. But the first two, the Hillsborough's Ron LaRaker's urban renewal plan, was a classic urban renewal plan in the sense of it needed the special land purchase and assembly powers that urban renewal has, because what they did there was they purchased, I can't remember the number of lots, but these were 15,000 square foot lots in the Ron LaRaker subdivision that had no utilities, no streets. It was a unusable residential subdivision that was done prior to statutes governing how subdivisions should be done. In fact, it was a cause of the statutes. And the renewal agency there worked with people all over the world to buy these lots and assemble a site. And that site now is where Intel has its Ron LaRaker's campus, with literally billions of dollars of investment and thousands of jobs. And the alternate location for those factories, it wasn't like we'll go into Hillsborough, we'll go to Beaverton, or we'll go to Medford. It was either going to be in Hillsborough, it was going to be in Ireland, it was going to be in Israel, it was going to be in Arizona. So these are jobs that are new to the state and generating income tax revenues that would not have been there but for that. Similarly, White City Urban Renewal Area north of Medford, one of the major employers there is the Kodak Company. They have a large medical imaging film processing manufacturing facility. They had two of these plants, one in Oregon, one in North Carolina. They were going to close one, upgrade the other. The Urban Renewal Agency in Jackson County offered them an incentive. They closed North Carolina. They expanded the Oregon facility by three times. We have in Medford the land around the Southgate Way Interchange. was a patchwork of property. It was owned by a number of public agencies, a number of private parties. There were major realignments that had to be done. A private developer would not have been able to have the tools to pull this land together and plan it and make it available for development. And the Medford Urban Renewal Agency did use those tools. They assembled the site, and it's a major commercial area for Medford, including that generates jobs. We have right now, in terms of new things, we have the communities in Beaverton and Tigard are looking at urban renewal as a way of spurring development or spurring additional development that would relate to the commuter rail line that goes from Wilsonville to Beaverton. No decisions have been made, but it's a tool they're looking into. And then finally, the community of the Dalles, which took a long time to get going. They had to overcome almost every problem possible. But if you go to the Dalles now, they have block after block of renewed streetscape. They have two or three major historic buildings that are renovated and occupied by businesses. There's economic activity that is happening in the Dalles despite the shutdown of the aluminum plants that has depressed the whole economy. So in summary, we feel urban renewal is a very powerful economic development tool. It's a good tool in the sense of it's under local control and can be used to address a number of different situations. It's locally administered. The people that run urban renewal are very accountable to their community because they're elected every 2 or 4 years. And in that context, we feel that House Bill 2187 is a very reasonable and fair way to implement the Shiloh decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cashman. Questions or comments in the ring go?
Thank you. Given the fact that we have the court decision, this bill isn't required so that you can continue with urban renewal.
That's correct. The what Mr. Phillips said was that in the absence of this bill, the administrative rule adopted by the Department of Revenue would continue to govern.
Mr. Chair, you would prefer to see it in statute.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, yes. We feel that there are some critical policy decisions here that would be better off in statute.
Thank you.
For your information, I provided, in addition to a copy of my memo, a fairly recently completed history of urban renewal in Oregon.
Could you walk us through that history? Just kidding. Any,
well, on page 36 at the top.
Yeah, well, just please, yeah, start on 36. Thank you very much, Mr. Cashman. We appreciate your time and testimony.
Office medicine.
No, this is what they do for fun in Beaverton, I'm telling you. This is new age stuff, man.
I noticed that there was examples of White City and the Dalles and Beaverton and Tigard and Hillsboro, but none from one community.
Have you seen
Forget the Dalles.
Gone with the Wind?
Frankly, my dear, is that what we're about to hear?
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2187. Committee, we'd like to hold a work session on this bill.
Sure.
Open a work session on House Bill 2187, which has not been amended.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Hannon.
I would move House Bill 2187 out with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Hannon has moved House Bill 2187 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Hannon, would you like
to? Sure.
Great. And our final bill of the afternoon is House Bill 2589. Mr.
Mouse. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is just to fit the occasion. 2589 also deals with urban renewal. However, this bill is more targeted towards confidentialities law, it allows the records that are in communication and in information from the Urban Renewal Agency to be exempt from public disclosure. The issues that I think has been the concern is in the page 3 of of the bill that you have. There is a whole list of the type of records that are for disclosure. Some of those seem to be very sensitive to businesses and other data of personal nature. So that bill exempts this type of information from being public records to be disclosed with no revenue or fiscal impact.
Mr. Lazenby.
The notorious enemy of public disclosure.
That's right.
Gets to the podium.
He finished revenue positive this weekend, I believe.
Revenue positive, yes, I am. For the record, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chip Lazenby. I'm General Counsel for Portland Development Commission. The City of Portland introduced this bill at my request. I believe, my view is that this is, I've submitted written testimony for you as well that outlines this rather than just simply recite that. Let me say that I'm not seeking to expand the documents that are exempted under law. What I'm doing is adding urban renewal agencies to a category that already exists. Housing authorities receive a lot of the same data that we receive as we seek to partner, especially with private entities and private corporations, to do development deals or to do rehabilitation of structures or to arrange loans or grants and participation with our urban renewal activities. Increasingly, I am being asked by legal counsel for these private entities if I can guarantee the privacy of their proprietary business information. And although there are several broad-based categories under the Public Records Act in which we can try to jam this information, largely the financial information that's in this section is what we ordinarily receive, pro formas, financial statements, balance sheets, things of that nature, that we need to do our due diligence to determine what an adequate public investment should be. So I'm simply adding urban renewal agencies so that we can then extend that assurance to our private partners as they seek our assistance in doing projects that have a public impact.
So can you think of an example of a risk that not having this law in effect, like a good example of a risk of some sort of deal that you would enter into or arrangement?
Well, as my written testimony, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my written testimony points out, this really came to my mind as something that we could do this session because of extensive conversations we were having with the May Company about the future of Meyer and Frank in downtown Portland. They need to shrink their operations down, but they're left with a 14-story building, which something needs to be done. The financial state of that operation, their sales history has to do with the valuation of the business and the building itself. Their ability to participate financially as well were things that we needed to ascertain, as well as private studies that they conducted to determine the seismic upgrade that would be necessary and what the rehab would ultimately cost. They were leery to share that information with us because we were really, and I sat down and noodled through this a little bit with their legal counsel, we were really unable to see that we could squeeze this into trade secrets or information generally provided to a public body. So as a result, it delayed us. It kept us from being more efficient in working with them. And the May Company is a company that's in a tremendously competitive environment. For those of you that have watched the retail industry, it has consolidated into two or three major players. And so how well a particular store is doing, what their profit margins are, how vulnerable they are is market data that a rival certainly would want to get a hold of directly, even though they could possibly derive it from other sources. So rather than put us as a third party in the middle of that competitive fight, I think it's easier for us if we have the ability to say to our private partners that we can receive this data, work with it to kind of figure out what our participation can be and what makes sense to us financially without them saying, well, we're going to withhold this or we are not going to let you have full information. It impedes us from doing our due diligence, Mr. Chair.
Sir Farrelly.
Mr. Lazenby, I would have thought that normal standard confidentiality agreements would be the order of the day in those kind of negotiations, and that would shield the entities, the civic entities, from having to disclose.
In the memory, Mr. Chair, of Senator Farrelly, fresh in the minds of people in Portland are the financial arrangements surrounding the private entities and the rehabilitation of Civic Stadium, which is now PGE Stadium. And there were non-disclosure agreements between the private parties and the city that were in force in that circumstance, and ultimately, through a district attorney's order and ultimately a court order, the city was forced to turn that data over. One of the things that I think is important about this bill that I point out to people as I discuss it is that the public investment ultimately in, say, something like Civic Stadium or in the Myron Frank, when the public investment occurs, that will be the subject of a public debate as well as public scrutiny at the before a dime goes out the door. All this bill really does is says to our private partners, in order for us to do our financial due diligence, you can give us your proprietary internal financial information for us to crunch the numbers and figure out where we are without you fearing that a reporter is going to turn this over to your rivals, or your rivals will seek to get it from us through a public records order.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank he was you. Doing fine until he mentioned baseball.
I know. Right I'm there. Sorry. I apologize. Can, can I roll that?
This whole side of the room. My little radar screen just.
You're out of here.
Well, in some ways, you answered, I guess, the concern that I would have is that if there's public dollars involved, doesn't the public have an interest in having the information available? And I understand that PDC is a good example of a hybrid agency that does public investment and then does arrangements with private companies. But I guess that would be the one flag that's raised in my head.
Where I personally fall on that, Mr. Chair, is I think that the nature of the public investment will be such not that it will not just be we're going to spend X amount of dollars on this. It's going to be, this is our participation, this is how we expect to get money out of it, this is the way our deal is going to be structured. And there will be something about what our private partners will be putting into that deal as well. What this shields is the internal solvency and the internal financial state of our partners, not the structure of the deal itself. That will be fully aired. But we receive proprietary information in order to work out our deal that really shouldn't be a part of public dialogue. If I'm going to do business with you as a private individual through the Portland Development Commission, I'm not certain that we need to see all of your financial statements and all of your bank statements and all of your stock holdings just to do a simple rehab with you or to give you a loan. And that's what I think the legislature had in mind when they let housing authorities have the authority to shield this data. That's really what we're talking about. The loans that we end up making, is that is it going to be a matter of public record that we've lent X amount of dollars to an entity or in a certain project? Certainly. That's going to be out there and that entity received it. But I don't think that simply doing business with a public agency, especially in private-public partnership mixes, means that you have to become a public entity and let everybody know what your total financial circumstances are.
Thank you. Any questions, comments? I think everyone's good to go. Closed public hearing. Anyone else on 2589? Open work session on House Bill 2589.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Hannah.
I would move House Bill 2589 out with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Hannah's moved House Bill 2589 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
So long as it doesn't pertain to baseball, I'm in support of it.
Mr. Chair, no. Given the environment we're living in these days with, PGE paying $14 million in taxes and having Enron steal it, and the investigation that the PUC is about to do on the energy trading that went on, I don't see why transparency should be shouldn't be our goal instead of allowing more secrecy. That just doesn't make sense to me.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Inga.
I mean, it's a response. I totally agree with that sentiment. I think the problem is that we do need to encourage private entities to to do business with our local governments on renewal projects, and they won't do that if they're going to have to put all their financial cards on the table face up.
Then
good analogy for the.
I guess it begs the question of, you know, why would you offer them public assistance if they don't cooperate with the rules? Well, under that line of thinking, you could make privacy arguments for anything.
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, the point is that those documents, that these companies are subject to severe financial competition. The question is, who are they shielding the information from? Are they shielding it from the government or from the public or from their competitors? And I think it is important that they ought to be able to come to the government and put some information out so that the deal can be evaluated and know that the competitors aren't going to have a look at their books.
Well, Mr. Chair, if you look at the example given, I mean, I think I just think that the public is better served by scrutiny over the position that the company takes on, you know, what the relative expenses are, and that, you know, Mr. Lazenby outlaid, whether they're seismographic or, you know, having to, you know, what kind of changes they'd have to make, and, you know, what kind of, you know, what their books look like. Without public scrutiny, you know, we could give away the farm and nobody would know until way after the fact, unless somebody, you know, with enough due diligence exposed it. I just don't understand why we can't have, if we're dealing with public monies, we're all about accountability. Mm-hmm. Why we wouldn't have that more transparent?
Senator Hannah?
Mr. Chairman, I respect my good friend from Cottage Grove. I think that his statements are pretty much in line with where I would ordinarily be. However, in this unique situation, there's proprietary interest of one business versus another business that if for reasons leaked out, it would put them at a competitive disadvantage. And that's where I have to kind of draw the line and say, I can understand it for this. Ordinarily, I would be with my good friend and say, let's shine the light in. But this is one of those cases where you can't always shine the light in.
Yeah, I would share that concern. I don't know that a company would enter in if their competitive position would be, that would be my fear, is that they wouldn't enter in. My understanding of the testimony is that the public would have access going in on the public side. Senator Farrelly.
Mr. Chairman, the reconciliation of the two positions here is this. There will be public disclosure of all the proprietary information that is being considered by the Urban Renewal Agency. It simply will not be available in a published form to the general public. It will be disclosed to the public entity's agents, and that is a form of public disclosure. It is not published public disclosure. So there will be an opportunity for due diligence. It will be in a chain of command to elected public officials that have responsibility for due diligence. That proprietary information will be used to make decisions about the solvency and the creditworthiness and the ability to repay and the likelihood of success of the long-term project. Those things are, in fact, a form of public disclosure. But to post it on a website, to disclose it to the general public, to publish it in general, to disclose it to competitors, those are the kind of things that would be prohibited by a confidentiality screen that this bill produces. So, you know, I think that these folks are essentially arguing about an issue that's very important, and I agree with the idea of disclosure, of full disclosure, to make these decisions, and I think that will happen. It simply will not be published to the general public. So I think there's every reason to support the efforts of urban renewal agencies to solicit partnerships with the private sector and bring people in. And the fear of disclosure of proprietary information acts as an impediment. So I really think that, you know, the purposes to which the good senator from Cottage Grove suggests we ought to pay attention will be paid attention to. It simply will not be published proprietary information. So I think we get there.
You can still vote now.
Thank you.
Open caucuses,
arrangements.
I'm opposed to open
caucuses. Except for meetings in the governor's ceremonial
office. I'm not spending any state money in an open caucus.
Oh, boy.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Uh-oh. Let's have the vote before the terrorists show up.
That's true. We don't want
too late.
Chair
Hogan?
No.
Aye.
Ringo?
Aye.
Aye.
Is an aye. Motion carries. Ringo?
Oh, Senator Corcoran.
Yeah, let me carry it. I'll establish some record for it.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Layman shows.